organized the workshop on the lunar regolith similar materials at Marshall, with the idea of, I mean, basically the same idea that Russ has here, is to drive requirements for various lunar activities and technology development. And so that's what I want to, I'm going to try to focus more on the lunar dust part and following the talks that were given this morning, and just want to drive the idea that there are requirements and there are feasibility issues as well, and there are choices to make, to be made. Next slide. So this this workshop was organized in January, and we are in the process of putting together a preliminary report that will be delivered to headquarters probably next week, and the final report with a requirements document on those materials at the end of June. So the idea was to look at the simulant needs, the definitions of those simulants, production aspects, cost and acquisition strategies, and to put together those specification standards. A science committee comprised of some major names in the lunar science community, so we wanted to make sure we had the right people. We had about the same kind of crowd, and we had a very good response. Next slide. So, we did go to the moon. Actually, I put the "we" in quote because as a three-year-old in France in a small village, my only contribution was to be made to watch TV in the middle of the night. So, yeah, I thank you for going. And
thank you, Matt.
Here
you are.
Exactly. So, and we learned a lot, apparently, because we brought samples, we had an amazing engineering effort to prepare to it, and we have direct account of what it is to be on the moon and what it means to actually work there. So these samples have been brought back about 380 kilograms and have yielded all the information we have, almost. But also what we learned is that the use of simulants over the years, especially during that time, the Apollo and the Lunar Rover program, when over 34 types of materials were made and tested, paid off because a lot of, just like Jack said this morning, a lot of these suits and hardware actually worked for their design period of life. So since then, the manufacture of new simulants for the moon samples have been driven by the need to of experimenters to look at extraction processes or transformation processes of the lunar soil into useful products. So that's where a lot of these folks are coming from the idea of utilizing the space resources. So I think this is very important that those two workshops actually end up working together, because you're going to have different requirements, which I think we need to merge into what those people have as a requirement. I want to point out, because it hasn't been pointed out this morning, that around 1989, a previous workshop was organized by David. And in 1991, the major source of data, still to date, I think there might be updated in the future, but still to date, is the Lunar Source Book. And it's a very comprehensive book. Incidentally, it's available now after efforts made at NASA centers, that it's been republished, not in the print form, but in a CD form. It's available for $20. At the LPI, Lunar Planetary Institute, their website. Next slide, please. So where are we now with lunar simulants? The problem is that most of the ones that have been manufactured to date, even the ones that people considered were very useful, MLS-1, JSC-1, are not available. They are not completely gone because people in their labs have kept buckets of them and are hoarding them away, and I'm sure some people selling them. But the problem now is that the researchers are making also their own cements and or buying from small suppliers that have different claims. And one thing that I think is worth noting is that no materials was made to specifically simulate the lunar dust. There were dust portions in JSC1. I think it's been characterized down to 4 microns. And so there is a fraction here that hasn't been really reproduced. Of course, over the past year, a lot of projects have been funded now by the Exploration System Mission Director to do a lot of work with some kind of material to develop their technologies. And next slide. So what kind of lunar simulants do we need? Again, this comes a little bit from that workshop. I think it applies to this workshop. We need to have widely accepted standard materials, just like Chris was talking about, the Mars simulants. You have to use everybody using the same materials to compare the performance of the technology developed. Simulants must be relevant to what's going on now at NASA. There's a lot of things that maybe we want to do, but there's not much interest until, I don't know, spiral 6, 7. So that probably would not be a priority in the simulant program either. The simulants must be prioritized just for the same reasons. And also, I think there is it's probably because of the coming of age of different missions to the moon, SMART-1, LRO, Selene, that new information will come, and also from the first landers that probably will then change our vision of what needs to be simulated. And then finally, the last question is, what quantities do we really need? Because that's a hard one. You have companies like Caterpillar who wants to dig a trench and fill it with simulants and drive a truck through it. But, and then, you know, some experiments will be just a few grams. So, next slide. So this is an overview of what is funded right now in some of these areas that require lunar materials. And I did not actually compile anything that was from the human side of the house, of this, but I would put it under the dust mitigation area. Next slide. So the workshop that we organized had a three-session approach. We wanted to have the participants look at what simulant properties do you really need to support the development of the lunar activities. And session two wanted to find a way to define a picture of what that family of simulants could be for everybody. What, in that case, you start looking at the combination of properties that might be needed for a simulant. And then session three, addressing the production feasibility and issues, characterization requirements, and the validation of those analyses. So what we did is we had about 60 participants in those sessions, and we used a network workstations or an electronic meeting system to actually gather in parallel a lot of those inputs. Next slide. And we did this by bringing together what we call a knowledge matrix, which linked the lunar activities and the lunar regolith properties, and see where they match. So we had an assessment value. We asked people to assess if the property had to be duplicated, and in what fidelity level, high fidelity, then must be duplicated at a medium fidelity. And then after that, you have low importance, not required at all, and unknown data. Next slide. And that's what it looked like from very far away. And we listed all those lunar activities. Part of it was we dedicated a session to dust effect and mitigation. And they had to work on that too. So I'm going to present a little bit of the conclusions. Next slide. So the simulant definition brought forth the idea that a concept of root and derivative simulants was favored by people. The idea would be to start with maybe two, three basic material that would be mined materials from various locations, and from that to actually derive those materials by either adding to them or just adjusting the different fractions in composition or in physical properties. The group one that was mostly concerned about physical mechanical processes, that they wanted to resume the JC1 simulant and to address the immediate needs, and then with additions of different minerals to reflect the location of the moon. Next slide. I'm not going to go over those too much because it's not too interesting for you. The physical chemical processes was basically the same kind of requirements, and they identified a more specific need for additional root materials to reflect the low titanium mare and the highlands regions of the moon. And of course, there's a lot of interest as well into the agglutinin material, the iron, the native iron phase, and the special glass content. So that is already entered as some sort of requirement. And that group three looked at the dust effects and mitigation. Their preliminary conclusion, and this is preliminary because, as I showed, we're aiming at the June 30th final report, and we're still gathering data from various people. So this is also a call to all of you who want to participate to enter your opinion and your knowledge into this process. For the biological and medical applications, the consensus was that the root simulants was a good idea because it represented the proper mineralogy, but it would have to be heavily modified to increase fidelity to the actual lunar finds. And they identified that below the 20 microns cutoff, suggested by David, was very much needed. They needed a close match to grain size distribution and the agglutinate nature. And the morphology and mineralogy was very important as well to them. The new additive materials was talked about, and looking at simulants that would actually be, that would depart from the root family, where you would just use pure mineral finds or others like pure silicates or even carbon. And also the idea of using what someone called electronic simulants, which would be, you know, when you cannot actually simulate something because of the environmental factors that you cannot reproduce, then can you actually model those behavior of the dust, particularly the charging radiation effect and the rheology and the diamond streams. Next. So on the simulant production, the estimation is that now we're looking at a need of above 100 tons. And again, the major drivers of those companies have been funded to actually do large-scale work. I don't think this applies to all the simulants, so there is work to be done to really target what needs to be actually produced. And the usage will probably be phased in time, so you don't have to produce that amount right away. And again, the idea was to define the specific requirements and maintain a quality control. The role of NASA was discussed as possibly a guarantor for quality and giving a stamp birth certificate on those materials and to perform some kind of curator functions. Again, there are budget issues there that we have to be careful with. And a need for a database on those materials to track their quality control, but also to look at maybe follow their use and who is doing what with them. Next. So what could be the requirements on lunar dust simulants particularly, because that third group actually identified this. I'm borrowing images of lunar dust particles or small particles from David McKay's chapter in the Lunar Source Book. What is interesting is that you have the different grain sizes. This seems to be important. This may be a major property. Are we going all the way to the submicron? Somebody pointed out to me that if you go very small, 100 nanometer or so, then those particles become lethal in some circumstances. And you go all the way to 20 micron. You need 20 micron particles for your toxicology study. Also, you have to think that the reduced gravity affects those particle streams and that the clustering, and that really is not known. So that affects what kind of grain sizes you want to look at when you want to duplicate. The grain shapes, this picture shows you that these shapes can be extremely complex. I mean, this looks like a donut, a deformed donut. And a very different aspect ratio, that's what they showed this morning. And also broken shapes. And these particles agglomerate with each other. The grain surfaces seem to be extremely important as well. We have a nanoscale nanoscale roughness and the micro roughness are both present on all of those pictures, as well as porosity and electrocharging. The chemical reactivity from the different minerals, but also the deposited chemicals from the solar wind elements is also a surface property that probably is of great interest. And of course, and also the mix of crystalline materials and amorphous materials, especially through the agglutinate. Next. So, what do you, I mean, this is something to think about. What do we really need to simulate in those? A lot of those properties are dictated by size. So maybe size is really the main property to go after. And then from that property, you take care of some of those. But you have a lot of chemical problems, chemical issues, you have optical characteristic and thermal characteristics, and the abrasiveness is linked to the mineralogy, and the sorption the adhesion properties. But these properties are not part of the grain itself, they're also created by the lunar environment factors. And that is something to keep in mind. You may want to actually simulate those properties, but in order to do so, you would have to simulate the environment that creates them. And that goes to the issue of feasibility and requirements. Also, because you are working on other environment factors that deal with the presence of human habitat, then you're introducing new parameters that are non-native from the lunar environment, but that also affect these. So how much fidelity do you need on those properties, even if they are known? Some of them are not really known. And how much do you want to actually simulate in order to do the experiments that you need? Next. So the feasibility issues will depend strongly on the accumulation of those required properties. You have to be very careful what you want and what you ask for. The choice of starting materials, whether you have to go and mine something or you actually synthesize those particles, dictate the processes that will be adopted to actually provide materials. There are many techniques available nowadays for submicron fabrication, if that's what's needed. The complex mineral chemistry at submicron levels, I think, this is an important characteristic that needs to be in the semen for toxicology studies that may force the use of actually of natural minerals, because it would be very difficult to synthesize. What I wanted to show here is basically an evolution from the nanoparticles to the clustering. You know, all those phenomena from agglomeration, clustering, flocculation being a dynamic process. Sometimes it exists only for a little bit, but and how it actually these set of particles that we know how to make can actually be substituted for some particular studies to the actual forms and to the actual materials. Next. So you can look at the different production techniques. I don't have an exhaustive list here. I wanted to give some food for thought and discussion. But you have dispersoids that are made mechanically. And typically what you end up with is a wide size distribution, which can be good, because based on the pictures that we saw this morning, you have a size distribution, even in the very small level. So you have all those these mechanical techniques actually produce materials, but in the general terms, they don't really take care of the small particles. They kind of discard those. So you have to think about if you're going to use these, and you have to look at how to gather that. And then you have all these chemical synthetic process, where you control very well the size uniformity, and even at the submicron control, where, for example, in plasma synthesis or salt gel, you end up making mixed oxide particles that you can tailor their diameter from the nanometer to the micron. You have also things like ceramic whiskers formed and could be chopped out to give you really the elongated forms, possibly. And of course, the big issue of nanophase iron synthesis, I think some groups are starting to look at that, and that's, I agree with Jack, this is going to be an issue. And something to keep in mind, usually in most of those production techniques, as particle size decreases, the shapes tend to be more and more spherical. It's harder to make actually odd shapes, and that's the advantage that the moon has, is that it has this way of making those things a very small scale. At small sizes, also, like I said, a dynamic flocculation will occur, and that goes back to a feasibility issue where you can produce a lot of things, but then what do you do after that? You have to keep them in a certain environment where, you know, you transport them to your test site. You have to make them where you actually work. All those issues are right there. Next. So that would be my conclusion. Basically, you know, we are engaged in something we can all work together, and that requires a lot of work. But we are at the beginning of identifying the materials and the resource that needs to be done. Thank you.
The exposure age came from that sample. scrape off the soil off the top of the boulder.
No, you can get it and flip it up in the boulder, you know, right? Yeah.